All right, hello and welcome to a new episode of the Jack Howlers podcast. I hope everybody is keeping well. I hope you all enjoyed the last episode that we did with Sheridan. Really, really great episode. I think anybody who trains female clients is a female lifter themselves. I think there was a lot of benefit in there for, yeah, anyone who comes under those categories. I actually learned a lot while doing that episode. You know, it was my chance to kind of ask a lot of questions that I didn't know the answer to whatsoever. And that's one of the things that I love about this podcast. That, you know, yes, okay, I can get people's opinions on stuff, but I also get to learn things as well. And hopefully you all do as well. Before we get into today's episode, I would ask that if you haven't already, whatever medium you're listening on, please leave the show a 5-star rating and consider subscribing to the show or following whatever medium you're on. Doesn't cost you anything, and it really, really helps me and the show out. Maybe consider sharing it with a friend or something as well, or on your social media. Really want to try and push this to as many people as possible and be able to get as many cool guests onto the show as I can for all of you guys and girls. So today, I really wanted to do something a little bit basic. I have a few topics that I want to talk about on podcasts in the coming weeks, but I really enjoy doing Q&As on my Instagram stories. It's something that I've done for a couple of years now. I always really like being able to help people via Instagram. And, you know, as much as I want to be able to sell coaching and all that sort of stuff, I like being able to give information out that can help people for free as well. And Q&As, I find, are a really good way to do that. However, I do find that a lot of the questions I get, especially as my following starts to grow a little bit, it's really hard to answer them just in one story slide on Instagram. And I want to be able to provide a little bit more of an in-depth answer, a bit more nuance, a bit more context. So I thought I'd put a story box up today and just take a few questions, see what you all have to ask, and we can kind of dive into them a little bit deeper. And the first one's a really good question, and it's something that I think, again, really easy to answer kind of in a one slide Instagram thing and just be like, yes, it's effective. But I wanted to dive into a little bit more info here. So the question is creatine useful in fat loss? So questions like this, we want to break it down into two different streams of thinking. Number one, is it useful? Yes, absolutely. And we'll get into why in a second. Number two, is it essential? No, it isn't. There's no such thing as an essential supplement for fat loss. So why is creatine useful while dieting? For the same reasons it's useful any other time, to be honest with you. Creatine supplementation has been shown time and again to directly correlate with increased levels of lean mass. And while you're unlikely to build new muscle tissue while dieting, creatine, along with adequate protein intake, is going to help further preserve the muscle mass you've already built. And it does this by improving your performance through increasing the levels of ATP, which is our main energy system for short bouts of maximal performance. Think sprints, heavy weightlifting, that sort of stuff. In fact, I actually made a post on Instagram a little while back about it's genuinely a running joke in the fitness industry that creatine is as close to steroids as you can get without actually taking steroids and having to suffer all the negative downsides of those. And it's also been shown recently to have a host of cognitive benefits too. And what a lot of people don't realize is we actually store, I think it's roughly around 5%. I'm not sure of the exact number, but I think it's about 5% of our body's creatine in the brain. So given that mental clarity and decision fatigue are pretty prevalent when dieting for the majority of people, could be a bit of a game changer to be supplementing with creatine to allow you to make more goal-conscious decisions while dieting, especially if it does kind of improve that cognitive function. The negative point people always point to is the idea that it causes water retention and bloating, but unless you load creatine and suffer some real gut irritation as a result, it's not how it works. Creatine does help suck in more water, but it's intracellular, meaning it heads into the muscle cell and helps to fill it out. You don't end up looking like a bloated marshmallow man from Ghostbusters. So yeah, don't have to take it, but I would recommend it. Is it going to directly influence the amount of fat you lose and how quickly you lose it and all this sort of stuff? No, there's no such thing as a fat burning supplement. Like, you'll see all these things kind of plastered out. The worst offender is OxyShred. OxyShred's always like this fat burner and all that sort of stuff. And it's like, no, all you're doing is giving people caffeine and increasing their heart rate for a little bit and making them feel a bit more energized. But basically, OxyShred is a glorified pre-workout. That's all it is. You know, and I don't judge anybody for taking it because I used to. I used to take it every single morning. I remember when I got introduced to it by a friend and he was like, yeah, this like fat burner helps you like lose weight, all this sort of stuff. And I took it every single morning, but yeah, it does not do any of that. EHP Labs are just very, very good at marketing. And their supplements taste really good as well. That's the thing. Like a lot of these supplements, they, you know, even if they aren't really that effective, they tend to get people by how good they taste. And EHP Labs always does a really good job with their flavors, I think, especially their protein powders. I've had like some of their like chocolate peanut butter Reese's Cup one. Wow, so good. Second question, why are mesocycles, so training cycles, generally 6 to 8 weeks in length? Is anything wrong with doing longer mesocycles? This is a great question. This is a really, really great, great question. And it's something that I do, I think about quite a lot. And I actually, a couple of weeks ago, I trained with a guy, James McIntosh. You can find him on Instagram, Coach James Mac. Really good guy, really good coach. And we were talking about this because for me, I often program in undulating 4-week phases for a lot of clients. So this means that each block is 4 weeks in length, and we kind of alternate between a block focused more on pushing volume and a block more so focused on pushing intensity, where intensity relates to absolute load. So the amount of weight that you're moving, which is kind of, it's a good way of programming to be able to balance people's training stimulus without needing to deload as much. You can kind of auto-regulate your training a little bit more. But he did say to me, you know, 4-week blocks, do you really feel like people get the maximum amount of stimulus out of this? And it's actually made me kind of reshape and rethink how I program, because I personally, when I train, I find by the time I get to sort of week 3 or 4 on a block, I'm really starting to feel it. But I'm also somebody who gets bored very quickly. So by the time I get to the end of week 4, I'm usually ready for a switch up. Depends on the program, depends on what I'm doing. But generally, I'll be a little bit like, okay, I'm ready to kind of switch it up and move on to something else, especially if the program is very much like a push-pull legs or something where I'm repeating the same workouts every 4 days or something like that. But yeah, I was kind of looking at it and he was like, well, you know, he does longer mesocycles, 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks. And there is nothing wrong with doing longer periods of time. So this is, when I'm looking at programming, this is kind of how I approach it. And it's firstly, how long do I feel this client is going to need to get the maximum stimulus out of the program? So if a client is newer to a certain type of training, or for any reason in week 1 and 2, they're going to have to start at a lower than desired intensity. Maybe they need to deload, maybe work's really stressful, maybe life just got really hectic for a couple of weeks. I want to make the program a little bit longer, and we may be gunning towards or even in excess of that 8 weeks for the programming block. As I said, for the longest time, I only really programmed 4-week phases, but for a lot of lifters, when I think about it, it probably isn't long enough to get the maximum out of the program, and they often either end up pushing too hard too early and peaking before the final week, or starting way too slow and not even getting to the peak at all. So I'm starting to come around to this idea that maybe 6 weeks is a bit of a sweet spot for most people to not get bored, but still be able to see a good amount of stimulus. But it will depend on the target stimulus of the phase too. Like if you're pushing mechanical tension or you're pushing more kind of strength work, you can probably push that out a little bit longer than say a really metabolically demanding program, whether that's kind of localized metabolic training or systemic. So there are a couple of things to look at too. Metabolic phases of programming, I usually only run for like 3 weeks because I really don't want somebody to kind of get really run down on that. And speaking of that, the second thing you're looking at is, are you recovering or is the client recovering? So if a client is recovering really well and still progressing by week 6, just extend that meso out until they're not. Like genuinely, if it isn't broke, don't fix it. We have this real obsession in the fitness industry with just kind of changing things all the time because it's like, oh, it needs to be fresh. It needs to be this. It needs to be that. It needs to be this. But generally, I actually find if you're programming over the long term, even if you're doing like 4-week blocks and you're changing some rep schemes or some intensity techniques, etc., generally, you're going to be continuing to use the same movement patterns. You might just change up the variations or so. So it might be that you do a hack squat for 24 weeks straight. but you start off and you're just doing regular hack, then you're doing 1.25 hacks, and then your knees start to feel a little bit bunged up. So you start reverse banding so that you can kind of take a bit of pressure off the knees at the bottom. And, you know, you're basically changing up the variations of these similar movement patterns to kind of help progress them, rather than going, I'm going to do hack squat, then I'm going to do barbell squat, then I'm going to do V squat, then I'm going to do reverse squat, then, you know, all that sort of stuff. So if a client is recovering well and they are progressing, then feel free to extend that meso out as long as possible. But similarly, you know, if you have a 6-week plan and you get to week 4 and that client is absolutely like banged up and they can't train, they're always sore, they're sleeping really badly, no matter how much food you give them, it's probably time to abandon that and move on to something else. Probably deload first and then move on to something else. And then the third and final thing, I've kind of mentioned it before, but are you fucking bored of what you're doing? You know, like sometimes you do have to be able to push through programs, and like, you're not always going to like every phase of programming. Sometimes you do things because you're like, this is just the right thing to do right now, and I just need to get through it. But if you're really bored and nothing is making you want to go into the gym to do that program, then it might be time to just move on. Like, you know, there's a difference between, you know, kind of just sucking it up and getting through it, and, you know, not wanting to go at all, and then getting there and just not being bothered, not training with any intensity. Like, if you're really, really bored, just move on, change something, tweak something, even do the same program, but like with, I don't know, maybe a couple of different variations sprinkled in to make it a little bit more exciting. So yeah, for me, I'm not really worrying too much about like specific lengths of mesocycles all the time. Like, I'll plan out training ahead, but I do switch things up a little bit kind of on what the plan is, depending on a client's biofeedback. And I'm looking at progression, recovery, and enjoyment as the things that I'm kind of gauging the most, along with, you know, how much is this serving their goal, obviously. The next question just says program design and designing rep ranges. Very broad question here. Look, the big thing here is don't overthink it, all right? Most of you listening to this are probably leaning towards your goals surrounding strength improvements and body composition improvements. So a lot of what you'll be doing is primarily in the 6 to 12 rep range. Why? Because while we can and will grow muscle, pushing close to or all the way to failure, anywhere between 3 and 30 reps when volume is equated, if we take everything into account, the 6 to 12 rep range just kind of ticks a lot of the boxes. You know, you'll be able to lift significantly heavy and get stronger, especially if you're towards the lower end of that rep range. You'll be able to generally push closer to muscular failure without worrying about your cardiovascular system or instability becoming bigger challenges first. You'll be able to actually keep track of your fucking reps, and you won't be rushing through any of your sets, especially if your coach has prescribed like specific tempos and stuff. One of the biggest issues I find with really high rep work is technique just breaks down, people start to get gassed cardiovascularly, tempo goes out the fucking window, and people just kind of rush it. Like, I would rather somebody stuck between that kind of 6 to 10, 6 to 12 rep range forever and progress in that if everything else was kind of on point, than varying rep ranges too much. Because the other thing too is, if you're always varying your rep ranges, like if you're doing 5 to 7 reps one phase, then the next you're doing 15 to 20, then the next you're back to 3 or something, like you're probably going to be finding it very hard to make tangible long-term progress. There's nothing wrong with working in these rep ranges, like especially pushing lower into the 3 to 5 rep range. Like, I do that all the time with clients, especially on bigger lifts like deadlifts, pull-ups, bench press, because I love that kind of power building style approach and believe that if you're going to get stronger, you're going to get bigger. And this is something that I've always loved, you know, right since I started training, back when I was doing like Don Saladino's programs and Steve Cook's fitness culture programs and stuff. I always looked forward to the heavy, like kind of 3 to 5 rep work. That was always really fun. And then putting a bunch of accessories afterwards. But I do believe as well that you do need to spend time where a movement is hardest and really focus on a concept that Kasim Hansen of N1 calls time under significant tension, which is less about how long a set takes, how many reps, how many seconds, and more about how much time you're actually spending where a movement's fucking hard. And I think doing that in the 6 to 12 rep range is most effective. Yes, okay, you can do like a set of 3 paused squats and it's going to be hard at the bottom and everything. But for me, you're doing 6, 7, 8 reps there and you're pausing, I just think there's more chance to get more effective reps there. And that's anecdotal. That's my thought process, like looking at the bigger picture. That isn't me looking at studies and going, okay, X paper said this, X meta-analysis has said this. It's more me going off, okay, well, what do we actually know? And then in practicality, how do I feel like this then applies? So you can kind of take that or leave that if you want. In terms of actually designing programs around this, there's so many different modalities you can use. Linear progression, undulating, daily undulating, weekly undulating. Like, it just goes on and on. And I think if you're worrying too much about all of these models, you just kind of get caught in the weeds and then you sort of miss the low-hanging fruit, which is just pick something that allows you to progress, essentially, when you're designing a program. You know, in terms of designing the individual workouts for hypertrophy, again, like there's research that does suggest doing things in a certain order. Like, and a lot of people are big proponents of this, like big compound movement first, which generally challenges you most in the mid range, allows you to move the most weight, then go to shortened position and then go to lengthened position. Cause once you fatigue the short, you've still got fibers left like firing and lengthened. But everyone you ask will have a different answer. So for me, whatever you want to focus on, do it first. Even if it's fucking calves or something, do your calf raises first, then assess your next priority from there and put that in, and then go again and again and again. Because remember, regardless of like fiber type and, you know, what the literature says on your fibers and how they like tire and stuff, I guess, how they fatigue, that's the word I'm looking for, brain fatigue at the moment. You always want to be thinking, okay, I'm most fresh at the start of a session. So how can I stay as fresh as possible as I go through? And how can I make the most of that freshness on the movements that I really want to see progression from? And finally, because there'll always be someone who'll ask, how many sets? The least amount possible that you can A, recover from, and B, see progression from. If you're always sore, you're doing too much. If you're never sore, you're doing too little. And if you ain't growing, something's wrong. Simple, but judge it like that. Do you ever use the adductor machine with clients? Yeah, all the time. I often use it as part of a squat warm-up, or I'll use it as part of like a quad focus lower body day, and I'll do 1 to 2 sets to like to failure at the start of a workout. I think adductors are a very under-trained muscle group intentionally. I think people unintentionally train them a lot, but in terms of intentional adductor training, not enough done. Lateral raises flaring up my tennis elbow. Any suggestions for alternatives? Have you tried doing your raises on a cable with cuffs? I find this can help with cranky elbows. Otherwise, just sub it out for anything that you can actually do without pain. It's really hard for me to give answers to these kind of questions because A, I'm not there with you. And B, even if I was, I'd probably be referring you to a local physio I trust to work on it first and foremost, get some answers and get some idea behind, okay, what can we do? What can't we do? How should we approach this? Like, this is why I always respond to these questions in Q&As with hashtag not a physio, because I'm not a physio. I'm just a coach. Can you talk more about your stretching experiment? Love the pod with Eugene. Yeah, of course. So if you missed it, I posted a clip of the podcast that I did with Eugene Teo back in January yesterday, and it was him discussing stretching and flexibility. And this was a really cool topic for the podcast. It was something that I didn't actually expect us to talk about, and I'm glad we did, because for me, I was always of the opinion that resistance training and improving your active range under load was all you really needed. So if anyone doesn't know what that means, we have active range and we have passive range. So passive range is just kind of where your joints can go with no resistance, not under load. Like basically, if you just reach down and touch your toes, that's your passive range. But if you were to do a stiff-legged deadlift, for example, with a lot of weight, your range would change. You'd probably reduce your range a little bit. And that's what's known as your active range. So I always thought that improving your active range under load was kind of all the stimulus you needed to improve mobility. And that static stretching, especially around training, was kind of dumb. Like I'm happy to admit that. But speaking to Eugene in January, he really challenged that belief. And he shared his views that while he thinks resistance training absolutely can help improve your range, that realistically stretching and teaching your body to get into those ranges passively is still very valid and important for increasing overall flexibility and potentially as a result, mobility too, because they are two different things. And he's also absolutely correct in that you can only really do so much length and range work under load before you have unbearable DOMS that can really mess up your entire training week, while stretching allows for a lower load, lower intensity way of improving range without having as much of these issues crop up. So the experiment that I did was I came away from the chat with Eugene and I was like, well, my opinion on stretching, is this, Eugene's is this. I want to see whether there's something to this. So I went, okay, I'm going to start stretching every single day here and there. Like, I forgot a few days, I will be honest, for the next couple of months. And I'm going to see if it helps impact my movement. And for me, a movement that we were integrating back into my training, me and Mark, was barbell squatting. So I was like, okay, my hips are really stiff at the moment. My dorsiflexion's not great and my ankles. Let's do some calf stretching and some like adductor, hip flexor kind of stretches before I squat. And let's do it during the week as well. And I did pretty well. I probably averaged about 5 days a week over the course of about an 8 week period. And I stretched for like 3 to 5 minutes before each session. I did the same stretching routine whenever I did it. Like, I'd do some loaded stretches for my calves. I'd do some static stretching for my adductors and my hip flexors. And then I'd go squat. And I definitely noticed a marked improvement in my sort of like squat mobility and my ability to get deep into the squat. I didn't change anything about my setup. Like, I kept the same setup that I'd always had, used heel elevation because I always use heel elevation, but I only used a very small 10 degree elevation, nothing crazy. And I basically just filmed one set every time I squatted and I had a look. I was like, am I more upright today? Does my squat look better? This, that, and the other. And overall, it definitely improved over the course of that time. And I've now not stretched really at all for like probably the last 6 weeks or so. And I've been squatting still recently and squats feel a bit more difficult again. So I do think there's potentially something in it to being able to improve that mobility. But I do think obviously it has to be specific. And I think just stretching for the sake of stretching isn't a useful, isn't like useful for your time. I think if you're going to stretch, it needs to be specific. It needs to be for a goal, and you need to be actually doing things that then allow you to see the tangible result of that stretching and see how effective it actually is. And you also need to be trying to progress it too. That was other things that I looked at, was kind of like, okay, am I actually making sure that I'm progressing these calf stretches? Am I trying to push my heel further down towards the floor? You know, when I'm doing this adductor stretch, am I actively trying to get a little wider or hold it for a little longer and all these kind of things? So yeah, that was kind of the experiment I did. It was nothing exciting. I just wanted to kind of see, you know, challenge my own beliefs and kind of, you know, push through something a little bit different for a change. All right, and final question is, love your content, but why so much glutes? Well, firstly, I have a very like large female following, and the majority of my client base is female as well. And that isn't to say that females only want to grow their glutes. Of course not. Like, they want to train lats, delts, hamstrings, quads. It's awesome. And I'm loving seeing women get into weight training a lot more and kind of build these well-rounded physiques. It genuinely, compared to when I came into the industry 5 years ago, things have changed so much for the positive, and it's awesome to see. But we can't escape from the fact that a lot of people like training their glutes. And I'm also finding now in the last kind of 12 months or so, there's a lot of men who enjoy training their glutes as well, because they realize like, okay, it's cool to have big quads, but if you got no ass with that or no hamstrings either, then it just looks fucking weird, you know? So I think a lot of people are coming around to the idea of training your glutes. And the thing is too, strong glutes equals strong deadlift, equals strong squat, equals strong unilateral movements, equals strong leg press, equals potentially less pain in areas around your hips and back. You know, that's not scientific. That's just potentially, you know, we do see a lot of stuff about kind of, oh, you got weak glutes, therefore you're using your lower back in a lot of these lifts. Like, you know, so good glute training is pretty essential to most people's programs. But also, I think it's the muscle group that's probably trained the worst on social media. I say trained loosely, like the idea of what people do to train their glutes is terrible. Because people don't actually do this shit. They just tell you they did this shit to glow their glutes. And believe me, they did not. And also, personally, I think people target women in all the wrong ways in fitness content and all that sort of stuff. I think, you know, while there's a lot of people out there doing a lot of good to bring more women into the gym and get them weight training, I think there's a lot of sleazeballs out there who are trying to take advantage of that as well. And they're kind of going, okay, women want to get into training, they want to get into weight training now, but they're still a little bit hesitant because they're scared they're going to be manly or some fucking archaic bullshit like that. And then they prey on that. And they give them these stupid band circuits or like Stairmaster workouts to get a sweat on and all that sort of stuff. And I think when it comes to men coming into the gym, a lot of guys come into the gym just because they're like, I want to get swole, bro. I just want to train my chest. All this sort of stuff. Like, that's how they get into it. So it's really hard to actually kind of profit off that, because guys are just going to come in and do 20 sets of bench press. You know what I mean? Whereas like a lot of women who perhaps are a little bit uninitiated to the gym and don't have the information and stuff yet, and are just starting to kind of get into it, they get targeted by all these people who are just kind of like, you know, buy my banded booty program or do this, do this, do this. And it's like, none of this actually works. And the annoying thing is that there's this kind of funnel on social media of like, okay, tell people they've got a problem with growing their glutes, give them workouts that don't work, give them shit that I said grew my ass because my ass looks really good from the angles and filters that I pick. But it's not actually what I use to grow my ass. But when they struggle to use it, I can then program for them, because they'll come to me and be like, how come this worked for you and it's not working for me? And then you can do this and do that and sell them this. And it's like, it's just not the right way to be going about things, you know? So I like to be putting out information around glute training to show people what good glute programming and good glute exercises are and how to actually perform those movements properly. And just, you know, I have a lot of fun doing that as well. I have a lot of fun recording those exercises and playing with variations. And, you know, the glutes are a big muscle group. You know, there's glute medius, glute maximus, glute minimus. Then we've got the divisions of the glute max, different functions in terms of like, you know, different types of hip extension are going to hit different fire. Like, it's a really fun muscle group to make content around. And a lot of the variations that you can play with are really fun. And then on top of that, a lot of the bullshit that you see on social media is really fun to pick apart as well. So, you know, I don't know. I like recording it, and I think it has a lot of value for people. I do try to record as much stuff for other muscle groups as I do for glutes. I think it's just more the fact that like glutes are the most concentrated of one muscle group, I think, because there's so much you can do with it. Like when you look at quads, for example, it really is just a squat movement and a leg extension. And then if you want a bit of extra, you can have some leg press or some split squats or some lunges or whatever, but you don't really need them. Whereas with the glutes, there's a lot more you can do. So yeah, I guess that's probably why. All right, I'm going to wrap this podcast up there. If you like the Q&A format, let me know. Send me a DM. Maybe I'll do more of these instead of doing so many of them on the stories. I do have online coaching spots open. They opened this morning, and I'm sending out an email to my mailing list today about that. If you would like to receive that email, it's not too late. You can still go and sign up. I'll be sending it out again on Saturday morning as kind of a resend. So if you are interested in working together this year, go sign up for the mailing list, because you'll hear about all openings and the way to actually book in to be a client and everything through that. Don't forget to share this episode with somebody who maybe sees some value. Leave a 5-star rating if you haven't already. I'd appreciate it so much. And I'll see you next Friday when we are back for another episode, hopefully with a guest next week. So that'll be another good time. Until then, take care. Cheers. Thanks for listening.